Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. All of it brought to you by Tripping.com. One search at Tripping.com lets you filter, compare, and sort over 10 million available properties, and you'll save an average of 18% per night by booking through Tripping.com. A little bit more on that later in the podcast. Jim, let's start with the good martini, and this is potentially mixed in a couple of ways, but ultimately I think it's good long-term for the United States. This morning, real Donald Trump on Twitter tweets out, Mike Pompeo, director of the CIA, will become our new Secretary of State. He will do a fantastic job. Thank you to Rex Tillerson for his service. Gina Haspel will become the new director of the CIA and the first woman so chosen. Congratulations to all. Jim, back in November, you and I had talked about a story, I believe that was in the New York Times, about how Trump had been considering this move for at least now 3 months plus, moving Pompeo from CIA to state. At that time, they were talking about Senator Tom Cotton moving to take over the CIA, so it's good that he's staying put in the Senate. We like to have him there. And ultimately, it would appear from whether it's their daily briefings or other time together that they have that Trump really likes Mike Pompeo. As much as Rex Tillerson seems like a decent guy who was trying hard, it was clear that he and Trump were not clicking. And when we've got a big meeting coming up potentially here with North Korea and some other challenges around the corner, you might as well have a team that's comfortable with each other and can hit the ground running.
Greg, can we now say something we've avoided saying since the beginning of the Trump presidency? Was Secretary of State Rex Tillerson a bad idea? You don't usually step from being the CEO of Exxon to being Secretary of State. He did come recommended from the likes of Condi Rice and I believe it was former Defense Secretary Robert Gates. And look, you know, no doubt Tillerson tried his best, but he was an unusual pick in a lot of ways because he was not no previous existing relationship with the president, either personal or a working relationship. I went back in history. Kerry had it. Clinton had it. Rice, Colin Powell, pretty much every preceding Secretary of State had some sort of preceding interaction with the president before stepping into the role of Secretary of State. Maybe that's a necessity for the job. It sounds like Tillerson and Trump really never hit it off personally or in terms of their foreign policy worldview. Certainly, it did not sound like Foggy Bottom and the professional State Department diplomatic corps liked Tillerson that much. I think it was pretty obvious he did not have a considerable amount of influence in the administration, and Trump didn't listen to him. Trump pretty much announced the North Korea summit without even consulting with Tillerson. So it's very clear that he had kind of become the appendix of the Trump foreign policy team. He was this leftover organ from earlier in the evolution of the system that had no longer served a purpose. Ideally, you know, Mike Pompeo, who by everyone's account has a good relationship with Trump, very often briefs him personally, the president's daily briefing. Maybe Pompeo and Trump know each other better and kind of have a more on the same wavelength. One of the things the Secretary of State has to do is go overseas, meet with foreign leaders, and advance the president's agenda, and also kind of know, like you're negotiating deals, you have to know what the president's red lines are. You have to know what the president wants and what the president doesn't want, what he's willing to compromise on. Look, this could be very tough to figure out under Trump. There's fair to ask there, you know, how much Trump knows what he's willing to give away and what he absolutely is, you know, has to insist upon. It's very clear that Tillerson just never meshed with Trump. And so maybe this was a mistake from the beginning. Maybe this is a better start for this. Pompeo comes to go pretty highly regarded from the CIA. The CIA has probably avoided any major controversies, incidents, scandals, et cetera, on Pompeo's watch. It's only been a little bit more than a year. So, you know, Pompeo also served on the appropriate committees back in the past, is highly regarded on the Hill. Confirmation should be fairly smooth. Promoting from within at the CIA, deputy director who just stepped in there earlier, but has a long history, worked under Jose Rodriguez, who was formerly head of the clandestine program. A little bit involved in some of the waterboarding, which I'm sure some Democrats on Capitol Hill will object to. But this looks like a fairly competent team. Now, the question is going to be, is this a president who wants to work with this team and is willing to delegate? Or are we going to see these sorts of things where he wants to handle things like the North Korean negotiations himself? Most people would doubt whether this is the sort of thing the president should be handling himself. Usually when you see heads of state get together for some sort of, you know, formal deal or something like that, all of the important negotiations have actually been done before them. President, the meetings of the heads of state, they're the cherry on top. They're the things you can use to finish all these sorts of things. Diplomacy seems to be going in a very unconventional direction on the Trump presidency so far, and we'll have to see if that changes in the coming months. Things may run smoother. It just kind of feels like an avoidable mistake, I think, Greg, that in the end, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was just destined to never work out.
Jim, I think you made a very important point that the handwriting probably should have been on the wall in the past couple of days when it was reported that Tillerson did not find out about the fact that Trump had agreed to meet with the North Koreans until the South Koreans announced it on television. And guess what else was announced without Rex Tillerson being told? That he's been fired. This is the statement from the Undersecretary for Public Diplomacy, Steve Goldstein. The secretary had every intention of staying because of critical progress made in national security. He will miss his colleagues at the Department of State and the foreign ministers that he's worked with throughout the world. The secretary did not speak to the president and is unaware of the reason. But he is grateful for the opportunity to serve and believes public service is a noble calling. He wishes Secretary-designate Pompeo well. And other folks are reporting that he didn't know till he saw the tweet himself. So whatever you think of the decision, it certainly could have been handled better.
You know, Greg, wasn't Trump known for firing people, right? On camera, on The Apprentice, sitting across the table, you're fired, you know, and declaring that. We heard that, you know, he sent it by courier letter to James Comey, now this one to Tillerson. I would not have expected Donald Trump to have a problem with face-to-face meetings and confrontations, particularly in a situation where he wants to fire someone. Somewhat strangely disappointing. And again, like I'd mentioned this in a corner post today, you know, we remember the moment where Trump said that Tillerson was wasting his time talking to Rocket Man, referring to, you know, the North Korea policy. Trump likes to publicly berate his cabinet members. And I don't think this is wise. And I don't think this is me just being a persnickety never Trump guy. If you want people to work for you, they have to feel like they're going to be respected. Even if you disagree with them very strongly, I'm not sure it's such a good idea to air that all publicly and so derisively, because now the question is, look, we have Pompeo, we have the people stepping in here, but if you want to attract the best talent, they have to feel like they're going to be respected by you. And that every time you make a decision they don't like, you're not going to suddenly take to Twitter to start, you know, hurling spitballs at them. So not the way I think a president should act, but that's, you know, pretty much par for the course with this White House, Greg.
Seems to be, Jim. I hate to end the good martini on a little bit of a down note, but if you do want to feel much better about this administration, keep in mind the fact that if Trump wasn't president, Hillary Clinton would be. There's our bad martini.
Okay, you win, Greg.
Hillary Clinton is in India, or at least was very recently, and she was being interviewed about the 2016 campaign, among other things. And Hillary Clinton has once again traveled down a road that makes you wonder if she's doing okay, really doing okay mentally, not even at a joke level, but whether she's truly delusional at this point. Because first of all, she was asked about, I think, the fact that she just lost, and she was talking about the electoral map. And yeah, Donald Trump won the Electoral College and won a lot more states than her, but it's how you look at the map that really matters and what those red states really mean.
If you look at the map of the United States, there's all that red in the middle where Trump won. I win the coasts, I win, you know, Illinois and Minnesota, places like that. But what the map doesn't show you is that I won the places that represent 2/3 of America's gross domestic product. So I won the places that are optimistic, diverse, dynamic, moving forward. And his whole campaign, Make America Great Again, was looking backwards. You know, you didn't like black people getting rights. You don't like women, you know, getting jobs. You don't want to, you know, see that Indian American succeeding more than you are. Whatever your problem is, I'm going to solve it.
Nice attempt there, Hillary, but I think people just don't like you. Let's move on to her next issue. She was asked why do you think that white married women didn't vote for the first female nominee of a major party? This is an extended answer here, and this is where I think her delusion even goes farther off the rails.
And part of that is an identification with the Republican Party. And a sort of ongoing pressure to vote the way that your husband, your boss, your son, whoever, believes you should. And what happened in my election is I was on the way to winning white women until former director of the FBI, Jim Comey, dropped that very ill-advised letter on October the 28th, and my numbers just went down because all, and I heard a lot of anecdotal evidence about this. People have written about it. All of a sudden, you know, white women who were going to vote for me and frankly standing up to the men in their lives and the men in their workplaces were being told, she's going to jail. You know, you don't want to vote for her. You know, it's going to be terrible. You can't vote for that. So it just, it stopped my momentum and it decreased my vote enough because I was winning, and I thought I had fought my way back in the 10 days from that letter until the election. I fell a little bit short. And so I think that it was part of a historical trend that I was bucking, and then it collapsed on me.
So there you go. Women only do what they're told, apparently, Jim. But they were going to stand up to their husbands. But then Jim Comey, another man, told them that Hillary was bad. So then they decided not to. And if you think it's just Hillary, that's not the case. And that's perhaps the bigger problem here as we go even deeper into the bad martini. It was just this past September that Michelle Obama said something very similar. There's no audio of this, so I'm just reading the story from our 3 Martini launch back in September. Listen to this. She said, quote, any woman who voted against Hillary Clinton voted against their own voice. This is according to Boston.com, but here's more of the quote. This is even worse. It doesn't say much about Hillary, and everybody's trying to worry about what it means for Hillary. And no, no, no. What does this mean for us as women, she asked, that we look at those two candidates as women. And many of us said, he's better for me. His voice is more true to me. And then she says, to me, that just says you don't like your voice. You just like the thing you're told to like. Jim, a lot to unpack here, obviously. We've got only racists and misogynists voting for Trump. We've got white women, especially married women, just doing what they're told in the ballot box. What do you make of all this?
You know, this is one of those cases where Hillary's, I would argue, erroneous explanation for why she lost the 2016 presidential election actually includes the seeds of the more accurate version of why she lost the 2016 election. At the heart of Democratic Party's philosophy today is not merely we have the right answers, we have better policies, we have a better idea of the direction of the country. It's we're better people than you. We are superior. When she goes on to boast about the higher GDP of the states she won, so she's kind of bragging she didn't win any of those dumb poor states, right, Greg? I mean, this used to be the Democratic, you know, used to be, oh, their bread and butter was, hey, we're the party of the working class. We're the party of the ordinary Americans. We're not the party of the rich and wealthy and all that kind of stuff. Now Hillary's saying, ha, look at those losers, those backwater red states. They don't have any of that wonderful high technology productivity that we have in New York and California and stuff like that. At the heart of it is that she won the good people. She won the smart people. She won the very best of America. And look, why would you even want to compete for the worst of America, Greg, other than the fact you needed to get to 270 electoral votes, you know, which is what actually determines the winner of the presidential race. What's I find perhaps most intriguing about this, Greg, is it means not only obviously we keep saying, oh, when is Hillary going to go away? Well, she went to India. You know, maybe she got her tickets on tripping.com. I don't know. But anyway, she goes out there and she's going to be asked about the presidential election because really, what else are you going to ask Hillary Clinton about? And of course, she's going to give her explanation of, well, here's what happened and here's why it happened. It's not surprising that she's not going to come out and say, well, because I'm a terrible candidate. Basically the Clinton Foundation was a favor factory for foreign powers. I was cozy with Wall Street while denouncing them. I was a faux populist. I represented the establishment in the economic establishment, the political establishment, everything that America couldn't stand about its current leadership, and I represented the status quo. That would be too honest. That would require her to look at herself too hard and to acknowledge her own fault in all these things. So she kind of has to turn to find some scenario where it's not her fault, where it's not the fault of her campaign, where it's all these outside malevolent actors like Russia and James Comey and all that kind of stuff, and that she would have won if not for all of these, you know, forces of evil gathering together. It's kind of this disturbing, very public therapy we're going through. I can only imagine, like, you know, Greg, picture a scenario in which Hillary wins. Donald Trump goes to, I don't know, let's go to Russia, right? Let's say Israel, Russia, some foreign country, and says that he won because, you know, the malevolent voters in the blue states who are snobs and you know, like people would be flipping out with good reason. You know, here's a former presidential candidate trashing the public for the choice they made in the presidential elections to a foreign audience. The one last point we got to throw in here, Greg, is that she pointed out that obviously it was the people who don't like black people. Obviously, he's arguing racism is behind the states, including people who don't like to see Indian Americans succeed, she says to an audience in India. Greg, I assume this covers Louisiana and South Carolina, two states that Trump won. I assume it was anti-Indian animus that drove all those people in Louisiana to vote for Bobby Jindal for two terms, to vote for Nikki Haley for governor for two terms. They hated Indians so much, or Indian Americans so much, they just felt the need to make them governors. That's the best explanation I can come up with there.
Yeah, and those racist states like Ohio and Florida, which voted twice for Barack Obama, and North Carolina did it once, and Indiana did it once, Wisconsin.
Voted
and
for Clinton a bunch of times.
Hillary Clinton does need to take a trip to fantasy land, because her explanation for what happened in 2016 is just not there. Unfortunately, fantasy land doesn't exist, but Disneyland does. That's in Anaheim, California, if you want a trip there right now. You know, you could pay a little bit more by renting a nice big house and sharing it with a bunch of friends, and you split it up. You could probably get a better deal for each person compared to the hotel rates out there right now if you wanted to head there for spring break for a few days just before Easter. Good deals found through tripping.com, especially competitive compared to some of the big hotels out there. But did you know that the average family visits five totally different websites before ever booking a vacation rental? You can spend less time planning your next trip and more time relaxing with Tripping.com, the world's number one site for vacation rentals.
Tripping.com is trusted by millions of travelers and featured by the New York Times, Travel and Leisure, Forbes, and more. Whether you're looking for a cabin or a beachfront home to get away to this winter, or you're already looking ahead to vacations this spring, Tripping.com can help you find the perfect place to stay. Vacation rentals can offer you flexibility, perks, and amenities you just can't find in a hotel, like multiple bedrooms, backyards, hot tubs, free Wi-Fi, even a fully stocked kitchen so you can plan and cook your own meals. This is a great option for families and large groups.
And I was looking at some of these houses out in Anaheim. They've got their own pool. You could use the hotel pool, but you have no idea what all those other people's kids are doing in that pool. So it's better to have one in the backyard of the house that you rent, and you can get a great deal at Tripping.com. With Tripping.com, one search lets you filter, compare, and sort over 10 million available properties on trusted sites like VRBO, TripAdvisor, Booking.com, and more. And you don't have to wonder if you're getting the best deal. You'll save an average of 18% per night by booking your vacation with Tripping.com. So don't forget, if you want to save time and money while booking the perfect vacation rental for your next trip, head to Tripping.com/martini today. That's TRIPPING.com/martini. Tripping.com/martini. All right, Jim, on to the crazy martini now. And tomorrow is walkout day, National School Walkout Day. This is going to happen at high schools and middle schools and probably elementary schools all around the country to protest gun violence. And one of the things we're seeing here is how the school districts, administrators, are openly embracing this, particularly in some of the more liberal districts. And we know from research done into how the students got quickly mobilized into political activists in Florida that groups like the American Federation for Teachers are actively behind this as well. Here's just a quick story here from WTOP, the major news radio station here in Washington. Students of middle and high schools across the D.C. area are prepared to join a national demonstration walking out of classes at 10 a.m. for a 17-minute protest of gun violence. Quote, "We support the spirit of the national school walkout," wrote Kevin Maxwell, chief executive officer of Prince George's County Public Schools, in a letter to school leaders. Prince George's and Montgomery counties in Maryland and Arlington County and Alexandria City Schools in Virginia are among the jurisdictions backing the student-led effort. All students are required to stay on school grounds and return to classes at the end of the 17-minute protest. To be fair, other places like Frederick County, Maryland, and Fairfax County in Virginia are not openly rooting on this demonstration. They're not condoning it. If the students do it, they probably won't be punished all that much. But, Jim, it's now becoming more and more apparent where the national unions and other powers in public education really are. And for parents who wonder if their kids really are being indoctrinated, I guess it probably depends on the teacher and on the district. But when you have this type of open love for the gun control movement, when you know if the kids wanted to do the same thing on the day of the March for Life, for example, it would never be condoned by these school leaders. So the bias here is glaring.
It is, Greg. By the way, I should point out that Authenticity Woods is in Fairfax County. We got that notice from our from the school district, and it basically amounts to, please don't sue us. Dear parents, you know, deep in our hearts, we agree with the gun control agenda, but we don't want to say we support this, but we also don't want to say we don't support this. We don't want the kids, you know, getting hit by cars going out, so we're not saying we want them to do that, but we don't want to tell the teachers that they have to go along with this. We don't want to tell the teachers they can't go along with this. Just please don't sue us, okay? We're trying to here we go. Here come the lawyers. Half the parents in this district are lawyers. Here we go. You know, that's kind of the subtext of that entire memo there. Look, I come to this as a great skeptic of the value of high school walkouts, as opposed to other protests. You want to do it on your own time, after school, before school, fine. You know, God bless you, kids. Go out and do what you want to do. But I do have this wariness about walkouts. Perhaps it stems to back in January of 1991, Greg. Stunningly, the Persian Gulf War launched on schedule, despite the walkout at Metuchen High School in Metuchen, New Jersey. All of the kids, all of the very best and brightest student leaders, and by that I mean the kids who would cut class anyway, were absolutely determined to walk out of class. And this was going to stop the Persian Gulf War, Greg. We were going to change the world. No, it didn't. And I went to class, just like everybody else, like you're supposed to. And anyway, my attitude is schools are places for learning. And there are a lot of ways that you can communicate. You can write to your congressman. You can email your congressman. You want to get together and do a protest on a Saturday or a Sunday, go to a town hall meeting with your member of Congress. You know, go right ahead. Go do that. The idea of I'm going to interrupt the teaching process. I'm going to interrupt the learning process. And I'm going to stand outside of a school and do something. Well, fine. I've seen these discussions on, you know, the Facebook. The fellow parents who think that I am a crazy Second Amendment touting gun nut who really should not be allowed to live in such a nice community or something like this, even they're a little wary about this. The elementary school my kids go to has everything from kindergarten to like sixth grade. So the sixth graders definitely want to partake of this. They've heard about this. They think this is a big deal. But at one point, the plan was to go out onto the school grounds and read aloud all of the names of the victims of not just this Florida school shooting, but of all school shootings going back to Columbine. So how do you explain that to the kindergartners who are out at recess? By the way, they do start recess that early at that time. You know, there were enough parents who were like, you know, can we make this age appropriate? How do we explain this to younger kids who may not be ready to you know about this? I'm very reluctant to show my kids anything about school shootings and stuff like that, because you don't want to start a panic. You don't want to start nightmares and things like that. You know, you kind of need to introduce these things age appropriately. And you have, you know, a group of activist parents, activist teenagers, activist teachers in some cases, and obviously you said these national groups that all are demanding that this. And I think this is what happens when being part of the resistance starts to permeate every little aspect of your life. You're not going to allow the schools to remain a depoliticized zone. You feel this need to kind of keel haul or drag kids into your political argument because you feel like they have a moral authority that is irreplaceable. Laws are set by adults, and I kind of feel like we should not be shoving this onto our children. Now, if this is happening at a high school, okay, maybe it's a different factor. But they are discussing this sort of thing in elementary schools, which leaves me grinding my teeth and understanding that there's a kind of a one-sided political mindset that is permeating the public school system. And I just love to talk to some of these administrators and say, would you allow the same thing to occur for a pro-gun rights rally? Or as you mentioned, for the National March for Life or things like that. Would they allow that? My guess is they'd probably, you know, look at their feet, shuffle their feet and say, well, because they really, you know, if you're going to permit these sort of things, they have to be content neutral under the Supreme Court rulings. But deep down, these school systems don't want to do that. They want the kids to be set on the right path politically at an early age. So deeply infuriating. We'll see how this shakes out, Greg. My sense is there'll be a lot of parents having to have a lot of awkward conversations with young children that they wanted to avoid. Thanks, activists. You know, good to know you're always looking out for us.
I'm reminded of the wisdom at a time like this, Jim, of a former high school history teacher. I think he's long retired now. He taught at a place called Ridgemont High School out in California back in the 80s, named Mr. Hand, who said, when you're in my class, you're on my time. And that's exactly how it should play out.
I was waiting for you to say whether Bueller would be attending.
Ferris Bueller would find a way to get out of class regardless of the protest, yes.
Yeah.
Jim, amazing day as always. Talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to visit our friends at tripping.com if you want to save time and money in booking your next vacation rental, that is. tripping.com/martini. And tune in again Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.